this point, I feel that a few words about communism and the Jewish connection is in order. We have all been led to believe that the communists are the implacable enemies of the capitalists, especially the super wealthy, and seek to rob them of their fortunes. The truth is very different. In his book, Zionism Rules the World, Henry Klein, a Jewish New York lawyer, wrote, in 1917, Schiff, Warburg, and their associates, super-rich New York Jewish bankers, financed Trotsky, real name Bronstein, and Lenin, real name Leonov, who overthrew the Russian government. Their revolutionary followers murdered the Tsar and his family and millions of persons in the Ukraine. Communism is no menace to money control. It is an instrument of money power. An official American intelligence report of the time of the Russian Revolution revealed, in February 1916, we learned for the first time that a revolution was being fomented in Russia. We discovered that the persons and concerns given below were engaged in this work of destruction. Jacob Schiff, Felix Warburg, Otto Kahn, Mortimer Schiff, Jerome Power, Charles Guggenheim, and Max Brighton, Jewish directors of Kuhn, Loeb & Company, Jewish Bank, Rothschild, subsidiary, New York. There is scarcely any doubt that the Russian Revolution, which broke out a year after the above information reached us, was worked up and launched by distinctly Jewish influences. The report listed all the people who came into prominence in the first Soviet government, from Zinoviev, real name Apfelbaum, to Tsiba, real name Martinow. A to Z, they were all Jews. A full text of the report appears in the book Plans of the Synagogue of Satan. The Russian general, Arsenij Gurevich, in Tsarism and Revolution, confirms that it was Jewish bankers who financed the revolution. Later on, according to F.J. Erzigler in Who Makes Our Money, the financing was handled by a syndicate of international bankers, which included J.P. Morgan and Rockefeller interests and Lord Rothschild. Rothschild spent over 21 million rubles in financing the Russian Revolution. The financier's participation in the communist takeover of Russia was well known among Allied intelligence services, but not a finger was lifted to stop them because they are the real masters of the world. In a letter published in the Times on the 14th of November 1919, a British army officer in southern Russia, an eyewitness of the Bolshevik Revolution, wrote, "The Bolshevists form about 5% of the population of Russia, Jews. 80 to 90% of the commissaries are Jews. In towns captured by the Bolshevists, the only unviolated sacred buildings are the synagogues, while churches are used for anything from movie shows to slaughterhouses. If a commissary, steeped in murder and rape with mutilation, happens to be a Jew, as most of them are, should he receive exceptional treatment?" His letter goes on to describe in horrific detail the bestial tortures and mass killings inflicted on the Russian people by the Jewish Bolshevists. Contrary to popular belief, bankers control both capitalism and communism. A one-time director of British Naval Intelligence, Admiral Sir Barry Somerville, wrote in his memoirs, From Admiral to Cabin Boy, that Parliament was controlled from behind the scenes by a Judo-Masonic combination. Commander Guy Carr, R.N., in his book, Pawns in the Game, quoted Somerville as stating, "International jury, headed by the Jewish bankers, was the secret power behind the world revolutionary movement." Carr's view was that the secret power Somerville referred to was, in fact, the Masonic sect known as the Illuminati. Many students of secret societies and subversive cults hold that the Illuminati was Jewish in its intellectual inspiration, and probably also in its leading personnel. It owed many of its beliefs to the Kabbalah and other esoteric Jewish texts. The gangster bankers created and financed communism and have kept it going throughout the years with massive infusions of Western aid. They created it and they control it. The confrontation between communism and capitalism is a pretense. The bankers, according to Douglas Lee in Far and Wide, plan to achieve their objectives through the clash between these masses. Only recently, a consortium of British bankers granted a loan of £3 billion to China and some £2 billion to Soviet Russia. This means that they have given £5 billion in credit, created out of nothing, to communists to buy British goods, mainly high-tech goods, which could be used against us in another war. Think what £5 billion would do to help our underfunded hospitals, the aged and disabled. The capitalist West, the communist East, are controlled by exactly the same people. Only recently, our race has given the world a new prophet. But he has two faces and bear two names. On the one side, his name is Rothschild, the leader of all the capitalists. On the other, Karl Marx, the apostle of those who want to destroy the other. For nearly half a century, the West spent untold billions of pounds, trillions of dollars to defend itself against an enemy which it created itself and continues to maintain. Communism in Russia would have collapsed years ago had it not been for the constant infusions of Western aid. And why? Because the Jews, who control both camps, have plundered the West to build up their system of communism, which threatened the rest of the world. The Soviet military machine is almost entirely the creation of the West. And there is no such thing as Soviet technology, only Western technology on Soviet soil. Since 1917, 90 to 95% of Soviet technology has come from the United States and Western Europe. We have built for, or sold, or traded, or given outright to the communists everything from steel mills to tire factories, from copper wire to motor vehicles, from missile equipment to computers. Major Jordan's diaries, New York, 1951, revealed that America delivered to the Soviets tons of materials for the manufacture of atomic bombs. Commander Bailey Groman, RN, stated in the British newsletter, Canada, that Russia had complete access to all of Britain's technology. Professor Anthony Sutton conducted a massive, in-depth study of East-West trade and published his findings in National Suicide, Military Aid to the Soviet Union. He provided masses of evidence to prove and confirm that Russia was made in America. John Stockwell of the United States Central Intelligence Agency broke his secrecy oath to reveal in his book, In Search of Enemies, that America and Russia are not enemies, but loyal allies pursuing the same objective, a one-world socialist-communist dictatorship. See Henry Kissinger, Soviet agent, by Frank Capel. Louis Marchalko, on page 227 of his book, World Conquerors, quoted Chaim Weizmann, the Rothschild-funded leader of Zionist Jewry during the first half of the 20th century, as saying, "We are one people despite ostensible rifts, cracks, and differences between the American and Soviet democracies. We are one people, and it is not in our interest that the West should liberate the East. For in doing this, and in liberating the enslaved nations, the West would inevitably deprive Jewry of the eastern part of its world empire." Several American intelligence officers have tried to expose the Jewish influence behind communism. Unfortunately, for reasons already stated, trying to obtain these books, as along with others already stated in this work, is rather like trying to find an abortionist in the Vatican. Colonel John Beatty of the United States Military Intelligence stated in his book, Iron Curtain Over America, that communism was imposed on Russia by Jews, that members of the same tribe had infiltrated the American government and administration and were the real directors of American foreign policy. Furthermore, they controlled the American media, were brainwashing the people, undermining the Constitution, and destroying America from within. Major Robert Williams of American Counterintelligence revealed in his book, The Ultimate World Order, that there was a Jewish world power movement hidden inside the communist movement, and that it is the Anglo-Saxon who must be undermined, softened, brainwashed, made to breed with the dark races if the Zionists are to win. He projected that the master strategists would precipitate a third world war between the Zionist state of Israel, backed by America and the West, and the Muslim world, supposedly backed by the Soviets. The real objective, however, was to destroy the industrial and military capacity of the West and communism. He regarded communism as merely a temporary tool of Jewish ambition and predicted that a Jewish world superstate would be built on the ruins created by such a war. He concluded, unless the American people recapture their government and smash the Zionist machine, the insane elements within that machine may wipe out mankind. Titus Reed stated that communism and Zionism both sprang out of the Jewish ghettos of Eastern Europe, one to undermine government from above and the other from below, and that the final objective of both these movements is the same, Jewish world government. The late King Faisal of Saudi Arabia, who, you will recall, was assassinated, revealed the truth about communism when he described Zionism as the mother of communism. In an interview published in Newsweek magazine on the 21st of December, 1970, he added, "It helped to spread communism around the world. It is now trying to weaken the United States, and if the plan succeeds, they will inherit the world. It's all a great plot. They, Russia and Israel, are only pretending to work against each other in the Middle East. The Zionists are deceiving the United States. The communists are cheating the Arabs. But actually, they are in league with the Zionists. Zionism and communism are working hand in glove to block any settlement in the Middle East that will restore peace." In his book, Deadlier Than the H-Bomb, Wing Commander Lennon Young states that there are only two reasons for colored immigration. One, to pollute and destroy our race by mongrelization. And two, to provide degenerate urban mobs which can be used for revolutionary purposes. He clearly identified the real driving force behind the plan to destroy Britain when he wrote, "The banking system which was foisted on this country in 1694 and during succeeding years over most of the world has been the main means by which the Jews have brought misery and impoverishment everywhere. By their manipulation of finance, they have been the cause of most wars and economic and social troubles. They have been able to obtain control of governments and of the means of publicity, press, radio, TV, films, publishing houses, news services, and so on. And so have been able to suppress the truth and propagate the lie. This has enabled them to fool and bully the people of the world into following the most suicidal courses until the Jews are now in the position of expecting to clamp final dominion upon the world by means of a supranational organization and some form of irresistible world police force, which they would control. If you think we don't have censorship in Britain, try and buy a copy from any good bookshop or borrow one from a public library. The United Nations is the prototype of world government. A prominent Jew, and a very brave man at that, Harold Wallace Rosenthal, wrote in his Confessions, "The United Nations is nothing but a trap door to the Red World's immense concentration camp. We, that is the Jews, pretty much control the United Nations." The UN has declared in its numerous conventions that there should be international interbreeding and a uniform world population. Successive British governments have supported these aims by subscribing to the Charter of the United Nations. This foundation document of the UN was, for the most part, drafted by Alger Hiss, top foreign policy advisor to President Roosevelt. Hiss was later convicted of being a key member of a Soviet spy network in America. Apart from Hiss and the man who exposed him, all of the leading members of this network, including the Soviet embassy officials who managed it, were Jews. In 1912, Israel Cohen wrote a book on communist tactics entitled A Racial Program for the 20th Century. it has proved to be most prophetic. We must realize that our party's most powerful weapon is racial tension by pounding into the consciousness of the dark races that for centuries they have been oppressed by the whites. We can mold them to our program. The terms colonialism and imperialism must be featured in our propaganda. In America, we will aim for subtle victory. While inflaming the Negro minority against the whites, we will endeavor to instill in the whites a guilt complex for exploiting the Negroes. We will aid the Negroes to rise to prominence in every walk of life, in the professions, and in the world of sport and entertainment. With this prestige, the Negroes will be able to intermarry with the whites and begin a process which will deliver America and Britain to our cause. This is why our bank-controlled TV and advertising industry are working mightily to promote the Negro, and why we now have Negroes and Asiatics reading the news and entertaining our children. Just how successful has all their propaganda been can be seen throughout by the increasing numbers of Britons rushing to commit racial suicide by cohabiting with the dark races and producing mongrels. Carried to finality, this means the permanent and irreversible destruction of Britain and the British people, which is exactly what the money lords intend. At this point, a brief word about the race laws are in order. The Zionist Board of Deputies of British Jews formulated the race laws, which now amend the Public Order Act and various other statutes. The first race relations bill was introduced into the House of Commons by the Labour Attorney General, the immigrant Russian Jew Sir Frank Suskis, in 1965. Draconian amendments to the Race Relations Act of 1976, which, for example, remove from the Crown the need to prove intent in prosecution for incitement to racial hatred, was passed in the House of Commons with only 132 of the 635 members being present. It is well known that numerous MPs are privately opposed to the race relations law, but they were terrified that if they went to the House and spoke up and voted against the amendments, they would be, what, smeared in the Jewish-controlled mass media as being racist, which might deprive them of the votes of the ever-increasing ethnic minority communities, or, two, make targets of physical violence by Jewish organized and funded anti-racist, anti-fascist rent-a-mob organizations, and, or, three, deprive of funding and patronage, personnel as well as political, from Jewish sources. So, on that crucial occasion, 80% of our MPs hid away in their footballs. It is thanks to these craven traitors that the Jews are able to make a farce of Parliament and get their way, even against the wishes of the vast majority of the British people. A subsequent series of amendments to the Act were introduced to the House of Commons in 1986 by the Lithuanian Jew Home Secretary Leon Britten, formerly Britansky, now a European Community Commissioner. You may wonder why all the various amendments to the Race Relations Act have had such extensive backing from the Home Office. Quite apart from the Jewish Home Secretaries and campaigning by pressure groups such as the Jewish Board of Deputies, there is a crucial factor of the behind-the-scenes influence of Jewish civil servants, one in particular being Neville Nagler. Throughout the 1970s and 1980s, Nagler was the head of the Home Office Department responsible for race relations matters. The Jewish Chronicle has boasted of the influence of this Middlesex synagogue official. It revealed that whenever a cabinet minister made a speech on the subject of race relations, notes for the text were always drafted by Nagler. The Jewish Chronicle also made it clear that Nagler regularly liaised with top officials of the Jewish Board of Deputies. These reports only confirmed anti-immigration campaigners' suspicions as to why the Board of Deputies was so well informed about their activities, personnel, and personal circumstances. The Board often betrayed through its subsidiary organizations and publications, as well as through the boastful columns of the Jewish Chronicle, knowledge which could only have been gained through official, i.e. police, special branch, MI5 facilities. The Home Office, obviously, has right of access to these intelligence data sources. Patriots were given further grounds for consternation when it was brayed in the Jewish Chronicle early 1991 that Nagler had retired from the Home Office and had been appointed full-time chief executive of the Broad Deputies of British Jews. The plans to promote racial chaos in the Gentile world were laid long ago. In 1850, Karl Marx, real name Moses Mordecai Levi, the son and grandson of Jewish rabbis, published his Communist Manifesto. In this, he advocated the abolition of the family, countries and nationalities, together with all religion and all morality. Who can doubt that this is now literally in the process of fulfillment? The evidence is all around us, with colored immigration and officially encouraged mongrelization. The massive assault on marriage and the family, and morality generally, by the promotion of pornography, explicit sexual videos, sexual license, a jungle cacophony that passes for music, and the slip-slosh daub and dribble that the gullible are persuaded is art, and ad infinitum. In a letter to Karl Marx, published in La Revue de Paris, the Jew Baruch Levi wrote, "The Jewish people as a whole will be its own messiah. It will obtain world domination by the dissolution of other races, by the abolition of frontiers, the annihilation of monarchy, and the establishment of a world republic." This is now all very close to fulfillment. The near complete success of international Jewish plan has been made possible by 1. Their control of money, 2. Their control of the media, 3. Their ruthless exercise of the powers which go with money and media control to stampede the masses and manipulate key individuals. One of many lessons of history which has been suppressed by the media and the powers that be concerning race mixing is the following. At the International Court of Justice, The Hague, on June the 23rd, 1965, evidence was given relating to the impact of diverse ethnic groups upon each other. At this session, Professor Van den Haag of New York University stated unequivocally before the court that it was a fact of history that unregulated contact between ethnic groups resulted in social disorganization and an increase in crime. Needless to say, this warning, placed before the World Court, made the professor extremely unpopular and received little publicity. Our ancestors fought and died to keep the Spanish, the French, and the Germans out when they tried to invade our island home. But the present generation of Britons have been cowed into silence and inaction while the biggest invasion in our history is taking place. If our ancestors were to return, they would consider us all mad or stupid or traitors. Half the world would like to come to Britain, not just the 2 million or so Chinese in Hong Kong who are poised to flood in. It is about time that our contemptible bunch of politicians started to put the British first in their own country. By using propaganda smear words like racist and fascist, the banker-controlled media have brainwashed the British into remaining passive and impotent while their race is destroyed and their country is stolen from them. In 1922, the Bolshevik leader, Zelenkov, stated in Moscow, "We must create a climate of anti-nationalism and anti-racialism among whites. We must reduce patriotism and pride of race to meaningless abstractions and make racialism a dirty word." How successful that plan has been. The British now shrink in fear of being called a racist. It is worse than being called a thief. Yet racism is no more than another word for patriotism. A righteous cause for which millions have died. To put one's own kind first is a virtue, not a crime. It is the greatest of crimes to help an enemy destroy one's own race and nation. And the mega bankers are the greatest enemies of the British nation in all history. Obviously, the people who have the power to create limitless amounts of money out of nothing and lend it out, as stated, control nations and governments, education, the media, secret societies, the churches, in fact, everything of any consequence in the land. Their control of the media is almost total. According to the confessions of Harold Wallace Rosenthal, they view the people as stupid pigs that grunt and squeal the chance we give them, whether it be truth or lies, and horses asses whose opinion they shape and fashion. When you buy a newspaper or pay for your TV license, you're paying for the privilege of being lied to, conned, brainwashed, and deceived, or kept occupied with masses of trivia that conceals much subversive material. From a correspondent of the Times, Douglas Reed stated in his book, The Controversy of Zion, by the way, try to get that book from the library if you can. Opinion today is a manufactured product and can be produced in any form desired. And the newspapers are under occult control, that is, under Zionist control. The newspapers and all the rest of our mass communication media are in the pocket and firmly under the control of a few super-rich Jewish billionaires like Edgar Bronfman, the late Robert Maxwell, Harry Oppenheimer, Armin Hammer, and the Rothschild family. Under the direction of these people, journalism has become an ever more disreputable business for professional propagandists and paid liars. A few years ago, this fact was stated by one of their own number. At a retirement banquet given in his honor, the managing editor of the New York Times, John Swinton, declared, "If any one of you dared to write the truth, he would soon find himself on the street looking for a new job." The major function of a New York or Fleet Street journalist is to destroy the truth, to lie openly, to crawl at the feet of mammon and sell his race and his country for his daily bread. We are the tools and puppets of rich men who stay behind the scenes. We are jumping jacks. They pull the strings and we dance. Our talents, our resources, our very lives belong to other men. We are spiritual prostitutes. Professor Arthur Butz, head of the engineering faculty at Northwestern University, USA, and author of Hopes of the 20th Century, a devastating expose of the Zionist Holocaust fraud, put the position rather more concisely. The media is exposed as constituting a lie machine of vaster extent than many of the more independently minded have perceived. At this point, I feel that a few words about an aspect of Jewish history which is generally unknown by laymen is in order. Few Gentiles realize that today's world Jewish community is divided into two quite distinct racial strains. The majority, about 80%, are known as Ashkenazim, or East European Jews. They are not the descendants of the 12 Jewish tribes of the Bible, but the descendants of a Turco-Mongoloid people who formed an empire in the area between eastern Turkey and southern Russia, called the Empire of the Khazars. This empire flourished after the Roman Empire had crumbled, and as the two great religions of Christianity and Mohammedanism were seeking converts, mainly by military conquest, the Khazar Empire was trapped between these two religious power blocks. The Khazar Emperor, wishing to maintain the independence of his domain, decided that he and his entire people should adopt a religious third way and become converted to Judaism. At that time, Jews of the 12 tribes had mostly been scattered from the Holy Land and were weak. A part of the remnant found itself in the land of the Khazars, regarded the Khazar Emperor's decision as a bit of a windfall, and happily obliged him with the mass conversion process. The bulk of the authentic Jews did not go northwards from Palestine, but westwards along the coast of North Africa, and from there they entered Spain. This minority strain of today's Jewry are called Sephardim, or Spanish and Portuguese Jews. The history of the Khazar conversion to Judaism is given in the book The 13th Tribe by Arthur Koestler, the well-known Jewish author and student of mysticism. The Zionist was much embarrassed by Koestler's findings because it means that their claim that all Jews have a right to return to the land of their ancestors can only be advanced by the Sephardim, and then only tentatively. The claim of the 80% Ashkenazim Jewish majority is entirely bogus. Christians are stultified in their attitude to Jewry because they believe that Jesus Christ was a Jew and that Christianity came out of Judaism. Both of these beliefs, although now well established, are lies. Jesus Christ was not a Jew. He was a direct descendant of Judah, the son of Jacob, which the Ashkenazim, or Khazar Jews, had never been. Jesus was a Galilean, as were all of his disciples, except Judas, who was an Edomite Jew. It was the Jewish Pharisees and Sadducees who were Christ's bitterest opponents and finally had him crucified. Christ himself uttered the most scathing denunciations and rebukes against the Jews, which today would certainly land him in the dump under our Jewish-imposed race relations laws. Christ called the Jews a generation of vipers, Matthew 23, verse 33. According to the eminent biblical scholar Schofield, in his Reference Bible, the word translated generation in the New Testament of the Bible means race. Christ also seemed to hold the Jews responsible for all the innocent blood shed from the beginning of history. Matthew 23, verse 25. The Jews, in fact, used the serpent as the symbol of their tribe, and have stated that when the serpent entwined the globe, they will rule the world. The Jewish film producer and scriptwriter Ben Hecht, in his book, A Jew in Love, expressed the Jewish hatred for Christ as follows. One of the finest things ever done by the mob was the crucifixion of Christ. Intellectually, it was a splendid gesture, but thrust the mob to bungle. If I had been in charge of executing Christ, I'd have handled it differently. You see, what I have done was to have him shipped to Rome and fed to the lions. They never could have made a savior out of mincemeat. Can you imagine it being remotely possible for anyone to remain a top scriptwriter in Hollywood, or as the BBC TV here in Britain, who expressed similar opinions about Moses or any notable character in Jewish history? The Talmud is the guide to the practical performance of Judaism. It is, in fact, many books, a compilation of the sayings of Jewish sages down the years. And an interesting point worthy of mention is this. If you wanted to borrow or buy from any good bookshops any of the holy books, namely the Bible, the Quran, the Book of Mormon, the Bhagavad Gita, you would have no problem whatever. But you try to go into a shop or a public library and borrow the Talmud. In actual fact, you would have a bit of a job to carry because it runs into about 30 volumes. Among other things, it teaches that all non-Jews are beasts of burden created to serve Jews, that all the property of the goyim, a word translated by Jews in works written for the benefit of Gentiles as meaning simply non-Jews, but which in fact correctly translated as cattle, rightfully belongs to the Jews. This is stated quite openly, for example, in Chosen Hamispat 388 of the Shulchan Aruch, which is a kind of resume of the very much longer complete Talmud, about 29 volumes plus index in the Sanchino English language translation. Before enlarging on the Talmud, I think it would be conceded by most people that the average vicar, bishop, clergyman, or holy man of any denomination, both East and West, Oriental and Occidental, are fundamentally humanists and have their fellow human beings' interest at heart. And one would also think the same would apply to rabbis. It is true, there are certain enlightened rabbis who are very humane people and some very, very brave people. However, at this stage, I would like to quote extracts from a speech made back in 1865 by a certain Jewish rabbi by the name of Reichel, made in Prague. This little-known document was published 11 years later by Sir John Lapton. The jury was very alarmed by this publication is well seen by two things. First, Ratcliffe was assassinated shortly afterwards. And second, it is quite impossible to procure a copy of this document anymore. And I'm sure the listener will agree that it makes very disturbing listening to any responsible person, regardless of creed or colour.
Here are the principal passages in which one sees how well indeed the ideas Reichhorn advocated over 100 years ago have come to pass. Gold in the hand of experts will always be the most useful weapon for those that possess it and the object of envy for those who are without it. With gold, one can buy the most upright consciences. With gold, one can fix the value of every stock, the price of every merchandise. One can loan it to states that afterwards one holds at one's mercy. Already the principal banks, the stock exchanges throughout the world, the loans to all the governments are in our hands. The other great power is the press. By ceaselessly repeating certain ideas, the press in the end makes them considered as truths. The theatre renders similar services. Everywhere theatre and press follow our directives. By an indefatigable campaign in favour of the democratic form of government, we will divide the Gentiles amongst themselves in political parties. We shall thus destroy the unity of their nations. We will sow the seeds of discord. Powerless, they will have to accept the law of our bank, always united, always devoted to our cause. We will push the Christians into wars by a judicious exploitation of their pride and stupidity. They will massacre each other and thus make more space where we can place our own people. The possession of land has always procured influence and power. In the name of social justice and equality, we will divide the great properties. We will give small fragments of these properties to the peasants who will desire them with all their heart, but who will soon be indebted to us by the very exploitation of these properties. Our capital will enable us to become the real masters. In our turn, we shall become the great owners of land, and this possession will assure our power. Let us use all our force to replace the circulation of gold by that of paper. Our banks will absorb the gold, and we shall decide then what value the paper money will have. This will make us the masters of every man's existence. We have amongst ourselves many fine orators capable of feigning enthusiasm and of convincing the masses. We will send them out amongst the nations to announce the changes that will make the happiness and prosperity of mankind. By gold and flattery, we will win the proletariat, who will take on their shoulders the job of exterminating Christian capitalism. We will promise to the workers salaries that they have never even dared to dream of, but we will also heighten the price of all necessities, so much so that our profits will be even greater. In this manner, we will prepare the revolution so the Christians will conduct themselves, and out of which we shall collect the fruits. By our jokes and by our attacks, we will render their priests ridiculous and eventually odious, their religion as ridiculous, as odious as their priests. We shall become masters of their souls, because our pious attachment to our religion will prove to them the superiority of our souls. We have already established men of ours in all the key positions. Let us make every effort to furnish the Goyes with lawyers and doctors. Lawyers get to know about every interest. Doctors, once they cross the threshold of a house, become the confessors and directors of their patient's conscience. But above all, let us get the control of the education, of the schools. By then, we will spread the ideas that are useful for us, and we will mould the children's brains as we wish. If one of us falls into the claws of justice by misfortune, let us all go to his aid, finding as many witnesses as may be needed to save him from his judges, until the moment comes when it will be us who will be the judges. What in 1865 must have sounded like the ramblings of a man suffering from a mental aberration has been proved up to the hilt by the underlying conception of world's jury. Before returning to the Talmud, if you happen to think that Reichhorn's speech was just a one-off, I would like to refer to an incident in history which occurred at the turn of the century.
About 1903, an official of the Department of Foreign Relations in Moscow unwittingly started a chain of events that was to keep making ripples in social, financial, racial, and political pools to this very day. A Professor Sergei Nilus, a Russian Orthodox priest, presented to Tsar Nicholas II of Russia something which must not only have been the most controversial document ever given to a monarch, but also the most lethal paper gunboat ever launched. When the Tsar had read the document in question, he declared it an outrageous forgery and banished Nilus from the court. The document was allegedly the minutes compiled at an international Judaic conference which convened in Basel, in Switzerland, in 1897, and became known as the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. The protocols, allegedly from specifically Jewish sources, although this has never been conclusively proved, propound in outline a blueprint for nothing less than total world domination. Not unlike the society portrayed by George Orwell in his famous novel, 1984, with themselves as supreme dictators. It included a long-term program for the gradual gain of power by infiltrating Freemasonry and similar organizations for the purpose of obtaining control of social, political, and economic institutions, and eventually seizing absolute control of these institutions in the Western world, largely through economic conquest and embroiling peoples and nations in a grip of debt. The document contains thousands of words of text. However, to give you an idea of the contents, I will simply read a few extracts. We will encourage the most extravagant luxury, the most fantastic fashions, the most ridiculous and enormous expenditure to eliminate gradually the capacity to enjoy simple and healthy things. Create a worldwide dissatisfaction, provoking distrust and hatred between the different social classes. We will rob the aristocracy, the holders of old tradition, of their lands by exaggerated taxation, forcing them to contract debts. We will poison the relations between the employers and the employed by strikes and lockouts, eliminating thus any hope of the good understanding from which a fruitful cooperation could result. We will demoralize the upper classes by every and all means, provoke the fury of the masses by the sight of the turpitudes and stupidities of the rich. We will allow industry to ruin agriculture and gradually transform commerce into a series of wild speculations. Encourage every sort of utopia to lead the people away in a labyrinth of impractical theories. Raise continually the wages without any advantage for the worker by the corresponding rise of the cost of living. Create incidents to provoke international suspicion and poison the relations between the different nations. Bring hatred to flower in the hearts of men and multiply ruinous armament races. We will give universal suffrage that the destinies of nations be in the hands of ignorant people. Overthrow the monarchs and establish republics everywhere. Intrigue ceaselessly so that the most important posts are held by men who have a pass to hide in order to control them by fear of a scandal and fear of the policeman. We will gradually abolish all forms of an honest constitution to replace it by the absolute despotism of communism. Organize vast monopolies in which every fortune will sink when the hour of political crisis comes. Destroy any kind of financial stability by multiplying the economic crisis, prepare the way for universal bankruptcy. Stop the wheels of industry turning, make all values collapse. Center all the gold in the world in the hands of a very few. Leave enormous sums of capital in the most complete stagnation. At given moments, suspend all credit and thus create panics.